The first section on the Series 6 outline is called Securities Markets, Investment Securities, and Economic Factors. And as we can see, there will be 8 questions on the exam here. So not one of the biggest sections, but an overview, a backdrop for a lot of other things that you'll need to know as a registered rep. So as we see from the outline, we start talking here about the securities markets, the difference between an exchange market and over-the-counter. As it says here, an exchange market is considered an auction market. They might say that they use open outcry where the best price prevails. So the New York Stock Exchange is considered an exchange market, an auction market. This is where traders put on their funny colored jackets and use their arcane hand signals. And if you're trying to buy, you're trying to buy at the lowest price. And if you're trying to sell, you're trying to sell at the highest price. Best price prevails. The over-the-counter market is called a negotiated market. The main securities here are going to trade on NASDAQ. Stocks like Oracle, Microsoft, or Cisco are trading on NASDAQ. But there are also non-NASDAQ OTC, or non-NASDAQ over-the-counter, and that would include the bulletin board stocks and the pink sheets. They're trading out there. They're not as well known. They're going to have smaller numbers of shares and less liquidity. So a big difference between having a stock on NASDAQ and over-the-counter bulletin board is that the NASDAQ stock has better liquidity, more activity, more buyers and sellers, probably a better price. So we're talking about the secondary market in those cases. Those securities have already been issued and they're trading among investors. We also see that they mentioned then the new issue market. That's the primary market. And in a primary market transaction, the issuer of the securities gets the proceeds. As opposed to a secondary market or a non-issuer transaction, that's a trade between two investors. As we see, you need to know that the role of the investment banker is to help issuers perform primary offerings. If it's a company, they're helping them do an initial public offering or maybe an additional offer of stocks or bonds. They also help states and counties and school districts offer their municipal bonds. So in any case, an investment banker is basically just a broker-dealer who helps to raise capital for issuers. And then we see some market terms, trade date, settlement date, DERP, Declaration X Record Payable. That just means that stock that is trading in the secondary market, the trade date is the date that you enter your order, but that transaction won't settle until the settlement date, and that's T+3 if they're talking about regular way. So if you buy stock on a Thursday, when will it settle? T+1 is Friday, T+2 is Monday, T+3 would be Tuesday. So that's the settlement date. That's the date that ownership transfers on the books with the transfer agent. And that has to do then with Declaration X Record Payable. When a board of directors at a company, when they declare the dividend, that's the declaration date, they set the payable date or the payment date, that's when the check will actually be cut to the shareholder. And then they say that you need to be a shareholder of record as of a certain date. That's the record date. So if the record date is on a Thursday, when's the last day you could buy the stock and still have it settle in time for your name to end up on the list by then? That's right, Monday would work. So if we bought it on Monday, T+1 is Tuesday, T+2 is Wednesday, T+3, the trade would settle. Your name would be on the list and you'd get that dividend. So if it's okay or there's enough time to do it on Monday, when does it become too late? That's right, Tuesday. So just go back 2 business days from the record date. That's known as the X dividend or the X date. On the X date, it's too late to buy the stock and get the dividend. So the amount of the dividend is basically just taken out of the stock price. So if the stock closed at 20 the day before, and then on the X date, since they're going to pay a $1 dividend, you're not going to get it. The stock would open at 19. And it says price and yield terms, market value, bid, ask, offer. When securities are trading on the secondary market, customers will pay one price and receive another. There is a market for a security because there are two prices. I can buy it at this price, but I could also sell it at this one. The price that a customer would have to pay is known as the ask or offering price. The price that you can receive when you sell is known as the bid price. So if you see the bid is $10 and the ask is $10.25, that means that the market for the stock is $10.25. If you want to buy the stock, you pay $10.25. If you're holding it and you want to get rid of it, you can only sell it for $10. So the difference between the $10 and the $10.25 would be the spread. stocks that trade on heavily traded markets are going to have a pretty narrow spread. There's no need to have a huge difference between bid-ask. But stocks that don't trade that often, we're going to see a much wider difference between the bid and the ask price. For mutual funds, you might see in the newspaper or on the website, NAV and then offer. NAV and bid mean pretty much the same thing. When you sell your shares back to the issuer, they give you the net asset value, just like when you sell stock, you receive the bid price. So bid and net asset value, that's what the customer can receive when she sells. She would pay the offer or the ask price, or maybe they'll call it the POP, public offering price. So these mutual funds that have sales charges, maybe the NAV is 10, public offering price is 10.50. Well, obviously there's a difference of 50 cents there. That's called the sales charge. If they talk about the yields and prices of bonds, remember that a bond is a fixed income investment. So if the coupon payment is 5%, you'll always only get 5% a year, 50 bucks a year, 5% of the par value. But if interest rates start climbing, the yield on your bond has to go up with it. So when you go to sell it, you have to sell it at a lower price. When you sell it at a lower price, and that's the interest rate risk that we'll talk about, when you sell it at this lower price, you're offering a higher current yield to the buyer, and they would also be getting a higher yield to maturity. So when interest rates go up, so do the yields, and the way that that happens is the bond price drops. Just like when rates go down, suddenly your 5% might look really attractive. You can sell your bond for $1,100 or $1,200. Well, the people that pay those prices are going to have a lower current yield than the nominal yield, and they're also going to have a lower yield of maturity, because if they pay $1,100, they're only going to get back $1,000, and they're going to factor that into their yield of maturity. So bond prices will move as interest rates move, and so that next item there, duration, measures how sensitive the bond price is to a change in interest rates. If it's got a high duration, every time rates go up, the bond price drops big time. So if the duration's 10, basically every time rates go up 1%, the bond price drops 10%. Whereas a duration of 15 would be even more volatile. When rates go up 1%, the bond price drops 15. So high duration is another way of saying a lot of interest rate risk. And it talks about investment securities themselves. So we were just talking about the fact that they're issued on the primary market, they're traded on the secondary market. Now we're talking about the securities themselves. Corporate securities, they start with equity. Equity always means ownership. How many of you guys own your house? All of it? Well, the percentage that you own is your equity. You could also own a percentage of a public company by buying their equity securities, common and preferred stock. Common stock gives you voting rights. It also makes you last in line if we go into a liquidation because the company can't pay their bills. Preferred stock is called preferred for two reasons. They would have a higher claim if the company went bankrupt, and also their dividend is more important. In other words, the company is going to pay the preferred dividend before they can think about paying the common stock dividend. Either way, if you own a share of stock, you own a share of the company's earnings, and if they pay any dividends, you have a right to receive those. So they might say that stock gives you a claim or a right to earnings, a right to dividends. Basically, a share of stock is just a share of the company's earnings or profits. So if there are $3 of earnings per share, you have a right to claim those earnings, and if they pay a dividend, you have a right to receive it. You also have the right to vote when you have common stock. You can vote on the board of directors, mergers and acquisitions, major changes of business objectives. Starbucks is going to exit the coffee business. That would be a little bit wild, so the shareholders would get to vote there. Preferred stock generally doesn't vote. So in exchange for the more dependable dividend on the preferred, you often give up voting rights. A few different types of preferred that could show up. Preferred, if it's 5% preferred stock, remember that you'll get $5 a year. It's 5% of the par value. For preferred stock, the par value is 100. There are participating preferred stocks where they'll raise the dividend to preferred whenever they raise the common dividend. There's even convertible preferred. That allows you to exchange your preferred stock for a certain number of common stock shares. And that's nice. That makes your investment less sensitive to interest rates. It also gives you a chance of some capital appreciation, or what we might call upside. So normally preferred stock is just basically tied to interest rates. Rates up, price down, rates down, price up, very interest rate sensitive. But if we tie the value of your preferred to our common stock, that's a convertible preferred, now it's less sensitive to interest rates. And when the common stock goes up, you might get some growth. So that's a way of getting a growth and income investment, whereas preferred is generally all income, and stock is generally more towards the growth side. American Depository Receipts, that's how you buy shares of a foreign stock, but they're actually trading over here as an ADR on the New York Stock Exchange, AMEX, NASDAQ, etc. If you don't want to pay and try to figure out what 1,192.68 yen would be worth, you could buy the Toyota Motors ADR in American dollars. Maybe it's $90, $120 a share. It's a lot easier to relate to, and you can trade it right along with all the other stocks on the American exchanges. ADRs do leave you with currency exchange risk. If the test goes there, tell them that a weak dollar would be beneficial. A strong dollar would not. And it mentions rights, warrants, and options. When you own common stock and the company wants to offer more shares, remember that common stock gives you an ownership stake. So you own 1% of the company. If they're going to offer 100 million shares to everybody else, you would no longer own that same percentage. So they send you rights. You have what's known as the preemptive right to maintain your proportional ownership. These rights are short-term subscription rights, allowing you to buy more of these new shares at a set price. And actually, you can buy them at a slight discount from where the stock's trading. Warrants simply lock in a purchase price for a long period of time. They're often attached to a bond offering. So if you're a bond investor, you do have a higher claim. If we go into bankruptcy, you almost always know you're going to get that interest check. But the problem is, you don't get any huge upside when the common stock rises. So if you own bonds in Google, you didn't get any of the benefit of that stock going from $85 to $500 a share. So if you're going to buy a bond in Google, they might offer you a warrant, which says you can buy a certain number of shares for a set price. So a warrant simply locks in a purchase price on the common stock for a long period of time, maybe 10 years. And it's usually attached to a bond because if you're willing to do the deal, they're going to pay you a lower interest rate on the bond. And in exchange, they'll give you this warrant allowing you to maybe make a big profit if the common stock goes up. So there's the company offering you a set purchase price on the stock. That's a warrant. Options, these are like little side bets between people who are betting on whether a stock's going to go up or down. Remember that bulls buy calls and bears buy puts. A call is just the right to buy stock for a set price. If Microsoft's trading for 29, maybe you don't want to tie up all your money in the stock, but you're convinced it's going to go up above 30 real soon. You could buy an August or a December Microsoft 30 call. Your strike price is 30. So if the stock goes above 30, you can still buy it for 30. What if it goes to 95? Then you'll probably never stop talking about it for the rest of your life. If you could buy a $95 stock for 30, that would not be a bad deal. What if it doesn't go up? Well, then you lose, but at least you only paid a little bit of money. If the stock's trading for 29, you want to buy 100 shares, that'd be 2,900. You could probably buy these calls for 200 or 300 and control 100 shares. So you put down a lot less money, you might make a huge gain, and then again, you might not. You can also make money because you think a stock's going to go down. It's called buying a put. So with Microsoft at 29, you're a pessimist or you hate Bill Gates or whatever your deal is. You think it's going to go down below 25 in a hurry. You could buy a Microsoft October 25 put. If it drops below 25, you can still sell it for 25. So what if it dropped to 15? That's 10 bucks a share you could make minus what you pay for the put. It could go to zero. That would be fun. Microsoft bankrupt and you make, you know, the difference of 25 and zero. You could buy a worthless stock and put it to somebody, make them give you 25 bucks a share. So bulls buy calls and they're in a position to buy stock at a set price. They have the right to do that. Bears buy puts. They get the right to sell stock at a set price, to exercise their put, make somebody give them some money even if the stock's worthless. Also remember that if you would buy a call, you would sell a put. And if you would buy a put, you would sell a call. And if this were the Series 7, we'd do another half hour, if not 8 hours, on the topic, but it's the six. So you got to know the basics of bulls buy calls, bears buy puts. And then they also, you have to know maybe that if you're bullish, not only would you buy a call, but you might sell a put for some income. If you're a bear, you'll buy a put, or you might sell a call for some income. And a covered call, let the words talk to you, that's obviously going to be safer than a naked call. Surely it sounds, you know, the options exchange in Chicago, it sounds a little safer to me to be walking around Chicago in January fully covered as opposed to naked, but that's just me. Debt securities, As we said, we can buy equity, which is an ownership stake in the company. We could also buy debt securities. So the company is really just going to borrow our money and give us an interest rate. Sounds pretty solid to me, especially if it's GE with a AAA rating or other companies with high credit quality. Or maybe I enjoy partying a little more and I like to buy the companies that have to pay 15 to 20% because they're so shaky. Either way, you just have to understand that, you know, when you buy a bond, it's backed up by maybe some collateral or maybe just somebody's credit score. So generally much safer than buying stock, but you never know. Bonds do go companies go bankrupt. Bondholders have been known to lose money. When United went bankrupt a while back, I read that the bondholders got 8 cents on the dollar. Here's your $80 back. Oh, that didn't work out too well. Of course, what did common stock get? Nothing. Okay. So I guess you have some bragging rights. You got $80 back off your $1,000 and the stockholders got nothing. But anyway, we see secured and unsecured bonds. A secured bond is backed up by a pledge of assets, just like your mortgage. In fact, there are mortgage bonds. That means they're backed up by real estate. Unsecured bond would be a debenture or even a subordinated debenture. It just means that it's backed by the issuer's full faith and credit, which is why you might want to check their credit rating on S&P, Moody's, or Fitch. A zero coupon bond means you get all your interest at the end. Normally, bonds will pay you interest every 6 months. So you got this 8% bond that's $80 a year. Maybe you get 40 on January 1st and 40 on July 1st. For a zero coupon, maybe you give the issuer $500 now, and in 10 years they give you $1,000. So you get all your interest income at the end. A convertible bond, just like convertible preferred, maybe you get tired of being a pure fixed income investor, and when your company stock pulls a Google on you, it leaves you behind. Well, if you buy a convertible bond, it'll be tied to a certain number of shares of common. So when the common stock goes up, so does the convertible bond. It makes it less sensitive to rates. It also makes it more of a growth and income investment, not just pure income. Mortgage-backed securities, including Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. The main risk there is going to be prepayment risk. You're receiving interest and principal from a pool of mortgages. When they refinance and pay off that principal sooner than you thought, you go to reinvest it into new pass-throughs or mortgage-backed securities, and you usually get a lower rate when you do that. So that's called prepayment risk. We have government securities. You see that these are the marketable securities, not the old savings bonds that you just keep locked up, basically, but treasury bills, treasury notes, and treasury bonds. They put them in that order. That's the shortest to longest maturity. T-bills are a year or less. Treasury notes are 2 to 10 years. Treasury bonds are 10 to 30. The bills, you buy them at a discount. They mature at face value. If you buy one for $910, you make back 90 when it matures at $1,000. The minimum face amount is $1,000. And it's very easy to get a good tutorial on these. I'm not sure they're major topics on the six, but you should probably know these. If you go to treasurydirect.gov, you can quickly get some more information on bills, notes, and bonds. The notes and the bonds pay semi-annual interest. The T-bills are simply issued and traded at a discount. Municipal bonds, we handle this largely through the tax implications, but understand that there are general obligation and there are revenue bonds. A general obligation of the state of Kansas is backed up by their full faith and credit, Kansas's full taxing authority. They're going to back it up with sales and income tax and anything else they need to do. Your school district, they're going to issue general obligation bonds backed up by property taxes. Sometimes projects are funded with revenue bonds because the facility is going to generate revenue, and we can use that to pay back the bondholders rather than raising taxes. A convention center can charge big parking fees, and they can get some money out of the vendors who will be selling coffee and sweatshirts and little obnoxious orange and blue pennants if you're at U of I, whatever. Industrial revenue bonds, I don't know. This seems to always be on these outlines. That just means that the city of Detroit is going to attract Microsoft to move there. They're going to issue a bunch of bonds in order to build the new campus. And then those bonds are going to be backed up by the long-term lease that Microsoft signs. So in an industrial revenue bond, it's only backed up by the corporation's credit rating. Money market instruments are just very short-term debt, like T-bills or negotiable CDs, where you buy this thing bigger than $100,000, not fully insured, and it's something that you can trade back and forth. Commercial paper is a corporate IOU. We will borrow $99 million from you now, and in 30 days we'll give you back $100 million. You make the difference. They even start talking about ETFs. Remember that an exchange-traded fund is a closed-end index fund. So you want to do exactly as well as the S&P 500. You can buy the SPDR. You want to track the NASDAQ. You can do the QQQ, the Dow Diamonds. You can even sell these things short when you want to bet against the market because they're shares of stock. Remember that you do pay commissions. They're very low cost in terms of management fees, but they do trade like stock, so you do have to pay a commission. Hedge funds, generally not open to the non-accredited investor, but these days you can buy what's known as a fund of hedge funds, which is a mutual fund where maybe a minimum investment of $25,000 is required. It's not as liquid, and it's obviously higher risk when you do hedge funds. For economics, understand fiscal and monetary policy. Monetary policy is implemented by the Federal Reserve, or they might say the Federal Open Market Committee. And here they are going to be changing interest rates and the money supply. To help the economy, the Fed is going to lower interest rates. So if we're seeing some bad economic data, they're going to cut the discount rate, lower the reserve requirement, and they're going to buy T-bills or treasuries to pump money into the banking system. That's known as a loose money policy. If the economic numbers are looking almost too good and we might be expanding too fast, they'll take some air out of this inflating economy by raising the discount rate, increasing the reserve requirement, and selling treasuries to take money out. For fiscal policy, we're talking about taxing and spending. That's Congress and the president. To stimulate the economy, they'll cut taxes or increase spending. And then to slow down an economy, they could simply raise taxes or cut spending. So that's a general overview of the first section, of which we'll have 8 questions. We're going to go ahead and call it here and take on another topic after the break.